Manager for Yammer, pretty cool title. Luke Grange, my colleague, is also a customer success manager for Yammer. We work in Australia, New Zealand, and today we're going to present, broadly speaking, on enterprise social networks. And apologies for the room, it's sort of gone that way, which is a bit like what happened to our displays.
Okay, so I prepared a presentation today together with Mark around socially intelligent computing. And a lot of the content that I'll be speaking on today, and primarily for the first part of the presentation, is excerpts and ideas from conversation that took place between Clay Shirky and Dan Goleman. Some of you may already know Clay Shirky, but for those who don't, he runs a course at New York University on enterprise social platforms and social tools. And Daniel Goleman wrote the book on emotional intelligence. And I was very inspired by this conversation that happened between them and prepared a presentation around that. So disruption persists. And I'm not sure if many of you know the story behind the Pony Express. Has anybody not heard of the Pony Express before? Okay. The Pony Express was basically a business in the States which took information and notes from one side of the coast to the other side at the highest speed that it could, with basically horses galloping until they reached the next station, and then they'd swap horses and take the next set of horses across, trying to move information as fast as they could to create a competitive advantage for a lot of big companies that existed and smaller ones as well. And this picture is great because what it depicts is the Pony Express riding past the telegraph as it started to get created, and they're building the telegraph line between the East and the West Coast. And in a presentation yesterday, I asked the same question, but once that telegraph reached the East and the West Coast, just as a matter of interest, who thinks that the Pony Express business industry lasted more than a year?
Anyone?
Well, you're all right, because it actually only lasted two more days. That's amazing, because that business had been going for quite a while by the time it went out of business. And the other thing around horses, but Henry Ford said something which I found quite profound, which is, if we'd left it up to our customers to come up with an idea to have more efficient and faster transport, they would have asked for faster horses. And I think what I'm trying to allude to here is, with regards to the way of the future and the way that we do business and communicate, a lot of the time we just don't know what we don't know. We've been working in a certain way for our lives and for a long time, and there is a new way of working that's coming through. And if we don't get to grips with this future way of working, we'll keep applying the same solutions and expect a different outcome. And that's what we're going to be talking about a lot on today. So each day we get into our cars and we are faced with traffic, and then we arrive at the office and are faced with an email inbox, which we fight to respond to and file and search and prioritize. Now, I don't think this is unique. I expect most people in the room struggle a little bit with this, and I believe that the traffic in Auckland is not necessarily the best either. It's also coming up against a few brick walls. But I'm drawing some parallels here between road traffic and email, and in my view, the entire concept of traffic is now relatively broken. And we tend to think, and we speak to government, and government speaks to us about building more infrastructure to solve this problem. And that infrastructure is establishing and compounding the problem even further. And in actual fact, I mean, online communication as well has come a long way since email was first widely adopted. But it too is becoming overloaded and in my view, abused to a great extent. And basically, even with email, throwing additional infrastructure at the email issue is not going to solve the problem. So we need to take advantage of new social ways of working. And these kinds of social ways of working are starting to infiltrate the organization. We see that happening, and we definitely see it in our private lives with social media. And we'll talk about that a little bit. We actually have a little video around that as well. But basically, we must address the way we work to improve this. And who knows, we might solve email and traffic problems at the same time. But what does socializing in groups while working on our own mean? And what are the challenges around that? And what does identity, and I mean true identity, individual's identity mean around this? And there are better ways and social solutions. So what I'd like to do is actually just switch to a video and watch what it is to work like a network and where that concept has come from.
Today, people are more connected than ever before, through social networks, through the cloud, through mobile devices. The world has become a giant network. And every second, people are sharing, learning, and making decisions on the go. They're all part of one hyper-connected world. These are your customers. They expect faster responses, personalized service, better experiences. As a business, you have to always be listening to your customers. Anticipate trends. Take action and adapt quickly, no matter what comes your way, so you can always stay one step ahead. You need the latest information at your fingertips to make fully informed decisions. And as a business, you can give your customers exactly what they want, when they want it, so they walk away with experiences as unique as they are. What if you were connected to everything important? What if you and every person in your company could work together like a network? Suddenly, you're plugged into everything that matters to your business. You're social and collaborating in new ways, exchanging ideas with people across the globe. You're always listening to your employees, customers, and partners. You spot new opportunities to adapt quickly and make change happen. You share documents and information in real time and make decisions faster than ever. When you're working together as one connected network, you can grow your business. You understand your customers, you build better products, and you deliver the best experiences. This is the power of a network. Now's the time to start working like one.
I must say I'm very fortunate in my job that I've joined Yammer, and we work as a team, we work as a network. So there's, as customer success managers, there are 60 of us around the world, and working like a network means this. If something gets posted on Yammer in our Yammer customer network, which has 14,000 at last count Yammer customers, and as part of an external social network, if a customer asks a question, working like a network, it might be that my colleague or our colleagues in a different time zone will answer a complex question about how to set up something for their new network in an airline business. We will come in the morning, if we're working in Australia, New Zealand, and find that already our network has answered that problem that's the customer has raised. So I guess there's 60 of us, but we're used to working as a team and working as a network. And for us, a social enterprise network like Yammer enables us to do that.
So we're going to explore the concept of group dynamics and individuals. But I'm just going to tell you, in addition to what Mark said, another personal story, which was when I was, before I joined Microsoft, the Global Knowledge Manager of IDP Education. And as such, in part of my role, I needed to set up three teams in India to do and build a database for me. And it was a lot of information that we had to collate. It was months and months of work where these three teams would work fastidiously every day to go through different university websites, taking all the information off of those websites and putting that into a database. And I established those teams not by having somebody in India go and recruit people for me. I went over and built those teams myself because I knew that that was the most appropriate way to build the relationships that I would have with those people moving forward so that I could lead them in the way that they were going to work and keep them together as a unit and have them enjoy doing what they were doing, because that's not easy. It was a pretty mundane task that they were doing, but I needed to make them feel like they were actually engaged. So social software is not better than face-to-face communication. It's simply better than nothing at all. And Wilfred Bion, I'm not sure if you've heard of him, but he was an amazing psychoanalyst from the middle of the last century, said something that nothing creates cohesion faster than an external enemy. And in cases where groups don't really face an external enemy, they tend to rally around the most paranoid member because that person is best at locating enemies where there are none. And that very much encapsulates a lot of what happens within online groups and online communication. So the group is a unit that's separate as a unit from the individual. And this is one of the least addressed parts of online social media and online enterprise social networking. So the group needs to be both effective and engaging. And I know that when we've been online before, a lot of, you know, you might get online to have a meeting and everybody's enjoying themselves, communicating, talking, discussing certain things and getting on. So the individuals are happy, but at the end of the day, the group goals are defeated. And that's effectively how we've designed most of our communication tools, around the goals of the individual. So we can only ask, how are we doing to get this done together if there's actually a sense of together in the first place? So the group has to exist as a unit and not as a set of individuals. And just to stay together as a group, it needs to create some way of living together in harmony. It needs a social comfort as much as anything. And none of that exists online. Online won't facilitate attaining the emotional core of agreement which keeps people together. I think this is a really important point, but constitutions, as we know them traditionally, they codify rather than establish sets of norms. And that codification is, you know, we see that in organizations written up in policies, and I'm not sure whether everybody here in the room works for a company where there are a lot of policies, but you tend to not be able to know all of those policies. And that codification, we still feel that social policy establishes norms, and in actual fact, it doesn't. Our political tradition as well has us focus on majoritarian tyranny, which leads us to the next slide, which I think you'll enjoy. So the majoritarian tyranny that we tend to be a bit concerned about, you know, big countries are going to come and attack the small countries and take them away or take them over and take all their minerals. So online, the issue is more autonomy risk. One individual can sometimes, without meaning to, cause an entire the entire network or entire community to grind to a halt. And online, there's no mechanism for the majority to redirect the minority. So online software or online community software appears to be optimized for mass arguments. from the outset. And I know there's been a lot of study done about this since the early 90s, when some of you in the room might have heard of the word flaming. It was an amazing time when the first communities online started to develop and we started to experience what that actually meant. But there was a lot of flaming going on. People would basically get into mass arguments and burn each other pretty much at the stake. But the most severe arguments tend to happen in groups and not as individuals. And a lot of this, a lot of the reason behind this is that sitting alone at your computer, your experience of personhood is so increased. And your experience of grouphood is so decreased, and it amplifies this effect. Your attention's focused inward, and you're not noticing, you're not even speculating about the other a lot of the time. You have zero empathy, and if you have zero, the arc to compassion that begins with attention, noticing, empathizing, feeling with, then acting, can't happen. So to the extent that people are inevitably self-preoccupied on the web, this tends to valence things towards a non-cooperative and non-empathetic end of the spectrum. So without empathy, groups find it extremely hard to come to a decision online. It's something that's quite apparent and quite hard, and a lot of software teams are trying to build software, enterprise software, that can help in the decision-making process, so decision support systems. We greatly overlook the emotional aspects in making decisions in favor of doing things like decomposing, ranking, and adding. And I think a lot of the time that's how we actually operate. We do that online, decomposing, ranking, and adding. And we feel like the outcome is an optimal outcome. Well, it isn't. The most often, the moment of consensus is announced non-verbally when people arrive at the decision, and this is not possible in enterprise social networking tools. So the asynchrony of a lot of our communications means that there is never a moment where anyone looks one another in the virtual eye as such and says, okay, we're about to decide. And a lot of that is around the fact that decisions a lot of the time are made before it's actually verbalized. So online enterprise social networking has no emotional signals in real time unless the thread is running. And what I mean by that is, and I'll give you an example, that at Microsoft, our Australian CEO recently did the ice bucket challenge. And we kicked that off in a Yammer thread, or she did. And immediately other people were donating. And you could actually see the thread running up your screen in real time. People were jumping in to donate money, comments were being made, someone was tallying the amounts in a calculator pretty much and putting what was going on in there because of the speed at which this was actually moving. But you typically have nothing in the part of your brain which does the emotional deciding, your prefrontal cortex, to latch onto, unless it's running in real time like that. So as individuals, the delay in receiving and transmitting information doesn't allow us to have that emotional valence that we need to make effective decisions. And there's typical things. I mean, body language is something that we do use a lot when we do make decisions. So I know by your posture, I know by your facial expression, by her smile, that we've agreed, and now I can announce that we agree. Online identity. So we're so fantastically attuned to reading individuals' faces. This is part of our DNA. We're wired for that. And it gives us more of a sense of who we're dealing with when we see somebody. And Malcolm Gladwell in his book Blink, where he talked about thin slicing, brought this into perspective when he realized that so much of the decision-making that we do and so much of our understanding actually happens in our subconscious, and then it gets surfaced extremely quickly, like in split seconds. And some of this is actually in around the avatar that you have in your photo in different social media platforms and enterprise. I think we neglect the importance of that. Somebody might have a picture of their child instead of them, for example, or they might have a picture of them when they were growing up, or they may have just something else. It says a lot about a person when they do that, and you can read into it, and typically we do, but just having a picture, a face of somebody. I know when I started at Yammer, for example, all the guys thought that I was overly serious because of the photo that I had on LinkedIn before they met me. You probably all think the same now anyway. But identity is, in fact, an incredibly multivariant perception, and it's something that we do store, and we store it in a part of the brain which is about 2 centimeters behind the ear called the basal ganglia. And this part, it registers an awareness. It's your felt sense. It's your life wisdom. And as you mature as an individual, you start to register the type of people, and you think, oh, that person, that reminds me of a person I used to know. I wonder if they're similar, or their voice sounds the same, so they've probably got similar traits. And you automatically, as individuals, we do this. We're constantly assimilating towards the emotional valence of the group in an offline environment. So we've got a group of people, and we're constantly looking at that group, scanning that group, using our peripheral vision, and bringing together what that group actually constitutes in our minds. Okay, and there's no software widespread used today that recognizes that people are different from one another. You know, whether somebody is new in the group. Some software, online software, does this, but it doesn't do it in a way that would help us actually assimilate and develop this identity. We need a simple mechanism for both letting people recognize one another's position in the community, but also letting them act on it in some way. And for social situations, the best possible set of reputation metrics actually resides in the brains of those using the software and not actually in the network. That emotional valence, which also is available to everybody, but codified by nobody. So when you start at work and you make friends with somebody and they take you out for a drink and they tell you about the different people that they've related to, and, you know, don't tell Sally down the hall about that because she's the kind of person who tells everybody. You know, those kinds of things that are not written down anywhere. They're the things that actually help us get through our workday and help us get through what we do and who we understand, who we can trust. So if the group notices a threat, there's a need to deal with it right now because it's getting in the way of the collective goal. And this is ignored online. If not, it creates mass confusion and appears dysfunctional. So for example, if there's a mine and somebody arrives to go down underground with that shift and they're drunk, well, the people who are going to go down with them underground are going to do something about that right there and then, because it's going to affect the group. A lot of the time, we don't actually get to see that online. So the software needs some kind of sub rosa or confidential way of expressing of interest or disinterest. The kind of thing that I generally tune into that individual, or that person tends to go on, and I don't tend to read what they put there. That's the stuff that's not codified. We need to try and capture that in some way, shape, or form and put that into an online communication tool. But we are getting there. This isn't about the fact that our online enterprise social networking isn't actually accomplishing a huge amount, because it is, and it's allowing us to work in a different way, and it's a lot more appropriate and driven to try and be inclusive than email is. But it's very important. We need to be far more intentional about what we bring online and what we do face to face. And I think that that's quite a mature approach to organizations and what they're going to start to address in the future, is that work ends up being something you do and not necessarily as much a place you go to. And it's only once we realize that and once we can start to work with that, that we can actually start to think about, well, when are we going to be face-to-face and when are we going to start to work in a certain way online? We also need to think about when two groups interact, you'd like at least one person in that group to know somebody in the other group and vice versa. So that's have them get to know each other. And Clay Shirky speaks about the umbrella model, where companies need to think about whether they bring everybody together maybe once a year and then they all spread back out to where they were before. Or he also talks about the Banyan principle, where you lay down roots and then somebody might travel across to from one team to another and visit that team and get to know them a bit better, and somebody from that team goes and visits another team, and just you don't need everybody maybe to get together. But he talks about these two principles, which I thought was interesting. And it basically means that after you've attuned into an individual, your communication with that person is forever changed. And you can influence those around you subsequently. So if I go and I travel from here, and we're actually off next week to San Francisco, where all 61 CSMs will get together. So that's a bit of an umbrella kind of model. But Mark hasn't necessarily met all the CSMs before. I was lucky enough to do that once already. But he's spoken to a lot of them online. And do you want to talk about what that feels like, Mark?
Well, I think not sure. I've been decomposing on the computer with my messaging, but I think if you have if you make an online connection with people before you get together, you know something about them, and it makes it easier to sort of accelerate how you can interact with them socially and get work done. So I guess, and I think we've all experienced that with those that use Twitter. Less so with LinkedIn, but other social platforms. You can build a rapport with someone, and then you can really, extend the relationship and how you, a lot quicker, because you've got something to interact with them about.
Yeah, and the thing that happens as a result of what Mark's talking about is that once we're then alone, that person still has a presence with us because we remember what they were like. We have that sense of felt presence. So another thing that obviously we need to do, and what I've alluded to earlier was, tough online, is we need to find some way to curtail the minority damage in group software. And that's sort of part instrumentation, it's part reaction, it's part social metrics. And then we need to allow the group to press those services at will. We must approach the problem with the idea that the group is a unit, as a unit, is different from the individual, and that both have to be satisfied, not just the individual. And one of the things around that is that we've found through studies that the concept of being polite online works wonders. I mean, I say it, but it really does. If we're polite, and then we interact in group, it lets everyone get the sense of one another's else's, respect. I think that's the word I'm looking for. And otherwise, we actually risk losing the group entirely. And we've seen it. We've seen where, we talk about so-and-so's crossed the line. Well, a lot of the time, when they cross the line online, it's a lot more difficult to come back again. And the current enterprise social networking tools work well for exchanging logic, things like source code, and it executes well in listing pros and cons to allow a selection to be made. But complex decisions, there are not that many online enterprise social networking tools that allow complex decisions to be made in a timeous manner. And our principal mechanism for enforcing any kind of group judgment online is through moral suasion, and that's generally invested in one leader. And part of that is as a result of the actual software, because our softwares tend to, our online software for enterprise tend to have groups, and the person that created that group a lot of the time has a few more admin rights. And just that sometimes tips the balance for them to be able to control some of the conversation or not. And those groups that tend to function best have someone who, through a combination of moral suasion and the ability to exert control via the software, keep order. And ideally, we would have groups where some transfer of power from the individual founder towards the group becomes stronger, or transfer of power from one leader to another as a group transfers as that group goes on longer. And until that becomes readily possible, we'll always have an overlap between successful groups and the groups where the founder is still the leader. So the fact that there are rules suggests to me as a member, so if you have these kinds of norms that are addressed by the group, so if you have these rules, it suggests to me in a group online that the members of that group are more cohesive, and that I'll need to align myself with those norms in order to be a member of that group. So the destabilizer in a group will often look for the imbalance of power in the group. They want to regard the group as not having a will of its own. If they sense that, then a lot of the time they might disrupt it without knowing that they're disrupting it because of their personality. So setting these norms will counter these individuals and establish a well-founded set of members with a common belief, an actual group. And just one last point that I want to make before we move on to the next part of the presentation is that those using the software should shift from trying to be interesting to be interested, as this is the part of the glue which binds us together as humans with emotions. So I've got a picture up here, a painting by Turner, The Fighting Temeraire. I'm not sure if anybody knows the painting itself, but what it is a beautiful, majestic ship coming in to harbor, and it's being brought in by a steamship, so a new technology. And this was painted by Turner in 1838. And the particular ship here helped Nelson win the Battle of Waterloo. So it meant a huge amount to Great Britain. But it's actually being brought into harbor to be broken up for spare parts. And the reason I put this up here is simply to depict that organizations, and in many respects individuals, by unlearning, organizations need to put something down before they pick something up in order to be most effective.
Whoa! So we're gonna leap from that conversation into how things actually can work online with Yammer. Who actually has used Yammer in the room? Right. And any other social? Who's used any other social enterprise? Chatter, Jive, anything else? Any of you? That's the way it works. Is we establish groups, so you can go into groups that are of special interest, or you can have a general news feed. We start like most social media with a post, but in this case we are talking about something on our Yammer customer network that I referred to earlier. And this was in the Launch Adoption Group?
No, Australia-New Zealand.
Australia-New Zealand Group. Do you want to talk through the process because you with Lisa?
So Liza Tinker is a customer of ours, and basically they were about to roll out Yammer across their enterprise, and she was looking for a video that she could help spread to her staff members that would explain exactly what was about to happen. And she looked and looked, and she found some stuff, but she didn't think it was necessarily relevant. So this was on the 26th of August at practically 11 a.m., so 10:59. And 10 minutes later, Gemma Smedding from another organization that's also in the Yammer Customer Network came through with the video. And in the thread there, you'll just see Liza saying thank you and Gemma saying no problem, that she spent hours doing it and she's sort of happy that she can help. And Liza says, thanks very much for saving me hours looking at for YouTube videos. And then Naomi Moneypenny at the bottom tagged that thread as a Yamwin so that the other 14,000 people, if they wanted to, could search for Yamwins and get value from this particular thread. So it's just an example of the power of enterprise social and what it can do, that it can save people time and help you and support you in the work that you do.
Just want to talk a bit more broadly about getting your work done using social enterprise. For us, we think for a social enterprise to work well, so this is social communication. Often, social is not the right word. It might be collaboration is a better word, but it's come from social media and how we sort of interact personally. The main thing I think for it to work well is you need some sort of business purpose. It needs to be put into an organization, and for a team, it needs to help you get your job done. To broaden out, you can connect a network. And as we saw from the video earlier, you can have a broad international network, or you can have a small network within New Zealand across geographical areas, or it can be different silos within a business. So you can make a network of two, or you can make a network of all the employees in a company, or an external network with customers as well. I was at a conference for online community managers called Swarm in Australia, and if you're interested in community management, I highly recommend it. It's a sort of world leading. And a couple of things came out of that is that a network is not necessarily a community. To a degree, that's something that's progressed down what we would call a value maturity model, which we'll show you in a second, which is a community is where the individuals will start collaborating and communicating with each other. Whereas to a degree, a network can start with a single organization and a purpose and then connect out from that. To a degree, if you like, it's like a wheel and it connects out. But it comes back to a central point. You have a community when it builds cross-intersections and has layers of interaction going on between people that are not in any way controlled or pushed out. So I guess when you start, you have a network and you push things out, and a true community builds something in depth. And we can talk now a bit more about what we would consider more depth than a social network.
Just to add to what Mark's saying as well is that every organization has all three of these things already, because we spend a lot of time with a lot of different customers, and you'll hear some of them saying, well, what we need to do is we need to establish a network before we move forward. Well, you've actually got a network. It's in there. It's somewhere in there. Believe you me, you just need to unravel it. And community is there. So it's just a matter of getting to work to try and champion and motivate people to climb on board and change the way that they do things. And this is a model that someone who we work very closely with, Simon Terry, put together. Simon Terry built the Yammer Network and community and championed it at the National Australia Bank, and Mark and I work quite closely with him. Mark?
Yeah, so the way Simon Terry describes it is initially we connect, so that's a and you could have a new Yammer network where someone is joined, for example, as a connection. From that, you progress to sharing. And that means that you're actually, that's when you go to the stage of actually being able to post things in groups and actually let people know what you're doing, what you're working on, and or it could be sharing, could be asking a question and looking for a response, as we saw earlier with Lisa. As you get to a sort of a more involved level of working and collaborating online, you potentially can solve problems. So you start to, the question is often early on is what, and then you can sort of how do we get things done? How can we solve issues? And I guess it gets interesting in Yammer networks when you start to look at solving customers' problems. If you're an organization with customers or members or public, if you're a government organization, how you can help solve those problems. And we would describe in this day and age that things are moving very, very fast, and we need to solve these problems a lot quicker. People are a lot more, I guess, get frustrated that things are not resolved quickly. And so we need to, I guess this is a way of actually, online provides an ability to do things at scale and speed. And ultimately from that comes ideas that we can really truly innovate. So if you empower people that are in part of these networks and help them with ability and a customer service desk to actually solve someone's problem, then they will often come up with ideas also of how they can innovate for elsewhere. So how, by solving something for one customer, you can broaden it out. So I do have another conversation I have with Simon, and I often introduce, which is the very similar model, but essentially it's the four C's. So it's the same thing. Instead of, you can look at it as a circle as opposed to steps. So we connect initially. We then communicate. So this is you're getting your Yammer network started. Encourage people once they're connected to communicate, let people know that they're on the network, what they're doing. That's the next stage. After that, you can start to collaborate. And we all sort of know how to collaborate to a degree over documents, and in Yammer you can do that sort of live. You can edit and sort of make suggestions live. So you can collaborate around a project, or you can collaborate around a document or a policy or something you need to develop. And after that, the next stage is cooperate. So that final innovation, which is an ongoing sort of level of cooperation, so that you're collaborating regularly and globally and across silos, and that's where we sort of get true innovation.
That's probably enough from us, I think. I'd sort of want to open it up to the floor to see if you've got any questions or anything that you want to put forward that you find interesting, or if you've got any ideas that you want to share with the room. Or but if you have any questions, let us know. Yeah.
Institute of Technology. So we use Yammer lots. We just started using it on ITS, and we've got about over 600 members on our Yammer network now. We use it
as staff.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yep. 600 staff.
Yep.
So what we've found really valuable is having a closed group just for ITS. So if anyone in our team has questions that they're unsure about, they post to the Yammer group. Anyone in our team can answer the questions, and we actually solve problems that way. China, which is awesome because we work in China and Saudi Arabia as well. So we've used this to set up networks across the world to work on projects with teams across the world. And we love it. It's great.
Yeah, no, thank you. Thank you for sharing that with us. I mean, we love WinTech as well, because WinTech are really testing the boundaries of enterprise social and Yammer. They're utilizing our API and are trying to write third-party tools and talking about doing that. So if you do get an opportunity to speak to this lovely lady over here about Yammer and what they're doing with it in New Zealand, please feel free, because I do really think that they're champions of what they're doing with it. Nice to know you in the room.
Has anyone else got a question or a comment they'd like to make about or a personal experience they've had using social enterprise in their workplace? No? Well,
fantastic.
Appreciate your time. We're around for the rest of this time slot, and we're around at a drinking venue near you at TechEd. And
just one last thing is tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock, we're holding a responsive org coffee at Mojo. So it's just down the road here at the corner of Queen Street in the ANZ building. So if you'd like to come along to that, it's at 8 a.m. tomorrow morning. We might have some of our customers there, and we'll be talking about how to be a more responsive organization or just sharing stories. Feel free to come along. Thanks very much.